Well, this is a rather august setting here for us.
I feel like I'm in the principal's office.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, I wanted to check with you on the homework, Roseanne. Gee, I thought you were going to say the lawyer, the psychotherapist. But, you know, it's a partner's desk, and so we're partners here tonight. This is a conversation about your great work. And I guess my first question really is, how is writing a book like this different than a body of work like your songs?
It is different. It's like going from watercolors to oils. But the thing I was surprised about, which I'm sure every great writer knows, but I found this out writing this book, is that there is melody in prose. And I kept trying to find the melody. And as a songwriter, I was more comfortable in short pieces, you know, really succinct kind of self-contained stories. And that's how I wrote the book. It's not a strict chronology.
It's not a through line, but
no.
But there's resonances between the chapters.
Right.
Kind of like an album where you'd have one track here and one track there and
well,
come back to this and that.
That's very interesting because I wanted to assemble the book as I would have an album.
Yeah.
With layers and, like you said, themes keep coming back. You know,
yeah.
The past and the future kind of collide.
Well, let me just say, I love the book. It's beautifully written, and it's an amazing account. And considering that you're just around the half century mark, it's incredible how much you packed in. But I think that
yeah.
She says yeah. You're not planning to do another one in 50 years, are you?
Well, you know, I wrote it thinking about writing more than one volume.
Good. I like that. Well, the thing that I was thinking is, as a songwriter, I mean, your songs come from life experience, but they're not always explicitly that. And yet, this is life experience, but it's got its, what's the term, magical realism. There's mythic qualities to your narrative, what you take subjectively. So there's a kind of a nice balance. I mean, this is not a work of fiction. It's a memoir.
Well, that was the one point that scared me a little bit, because in writing songs, even if they're taken directly from my life,
right.
Even if all of the artifacts are accurate and the documentary details, there's still some poetic license.
I can't pin it on you.
That's right. And only I know where the poetic license is.
Yeah.
But with a memoir, you know, by definition, I felt a responsibility to be as factual as I could.
Right.
But I did say in the foreword that my sisters may not remember these things exactly
as I did. That's right. Oral history is not an exact science.
That's right.
It is very subjective. I would argue everything's subjective, even social science.
Even facts.
Yeah, that's right. The ones you choose and think are important.
Well, true. And I said that too, that how you remember is as important as what you remember.
Sure.
Yeah.
And our memories are mysterious. It's part of our consciousness and how we think and rethink and remember.
Not only memory is mysterious, but time is mysterious. Mm. That's the other thing I kept coming up against while writing, is that time was mutable. Things that still had echoes from the past that were in the present and probably going into the future, it felt the same. I mean, to revisit those places, it felt more thematic than linear time.
I gotcha.
You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, you read the pages in a linear way, but I mean, the fact is, all of this is compressed into the book. I still love the analog world of books. And,
me
and,
too.
I mean, I don't read on Kindles, et cetera. I hope that wasn't product placement, but I...
no, it was the reverse of product
placement. Yeah, that's right, it was. It was anti-product placement. Thank you for that. I feel much more... you're going to help me here, I can tell. But still, though, things do exist in time, and you build things, and they resonate, and you know, it becomes your own time. But to me, the book is filled with the intangibility of relationship to... effectively, your own mother and your second mother, your father, of course, boyfriends, husbands,
children,
and words and music too, almost as actors themselves.
Yes.
And I think that's a great thing. But you know, you've always been extremely, I think, conscious of your consciousness and your feelings about yourself and the world of art. I mean, was this enjoyable to write for the most part for you, going through all this?
You know, Lillian Hellman said, "I hate writing, I love having written." I felt somewhat like that. Some of it, Some of it was more fun to revisit than other. I mean, there were certain things I couldn't leave out. I couldn't leave out writing about my parents' deaths. Sure. That was just excruciating to revisit. Mm. And I kept putting it off and putting it off. And, you know, my editor finally said, I'm sorry, but you have to put this in, you know.
Right.
It's
sure.
such a big part of your life.
Passing.
So at the end of this, I felt that I had organized some things in my life that had been kind of messy.
Mm-hmm. In telling the tale, you contain the pain, the joy, everything is once together.
And on a psychic level, it was kind of, you know, jumbled. But writing about it, I saw the themes.
Right.
I saw the people who had really influenced me, who were important to me. I mean, I even saw my parents in a better way. You know, the grudges disappeared.
Yeah.
The things you hold against your parent, you know, the how they screwed you up, or you know, what they didn't do for you. All of that just kind of faded.
Right.
As my friend says, it's like a picture in the sun. It just starts to fade. So all of the, and I appreciated them for who they were, separate from being my parents.
Right.
It seems such an obvious thing, and a thing that most people come to in middle age.
Yeah.
But I had to write a book to do it.
I mean, to me, all the profound stuff is really simple like that.
Yes.
And you have to experience it and do it, and you contain it. But I think what makes the book special is not just because you're a great writer, and not just because you've had all these incredible experiences, but somehow you've been able to, I mean, everybody can relate to many of, to the stories in
Absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely.
You know, we all grew up, we all think we get more mature, then we decided we really didn't, and we find out who we love, but we can't live with them, and, you know, I mean, we all have these issues. It's in higher relief, I think, when your dad is one of the great songmakers of the 20th century.
Sure, but as you said, the experiences are the same. You are insecure. You want to know what you do well in this world.
Right.
You try to find out. You fail, you succeed. You fail, you succeed. You want to see who you are separate from your parents. You fall in love. You get your heart broken. Your parents die. You gain some mastery over your own work and your own life.
Right.
You find true love. I mean, none of this has just happened to me.
No, right? But I think the way your voice in it is great because of that. It feels like you're sharing that and in a good way, and you come out of it feeling like you've been through your life, but you've been through your life, our life, whatever. And I love that about it. You know, we could talk about so many things, but as a singer-songwriter, you know, you've been a big star in the world of country music, and then you've sort of left that world behind. But we were talking about how it's changed, and I know you've got the guitar here, and I wondered if you'd mind giving us Seven-Year Ache, telling us a little bit about that song.
Yeah. Sure. Should I go over now?
Ms. Cash is now approaching the microphone. I wanted to cover the set change, really elegant, you know.
I wrote this song when I was 23 years old, which is younger than my daughter who's making records now, which is such an odd feeling. And I wrote it, I was living in California, and Ricky Lee Jones' first record came out. And I loved it so much. And I thought, wow, there's never really been a country song about street life. It was kind of the anti-definition of country music, right? But I wanted to write one, so I worked and worked and worked on it. It was 4 pages of lyrics, and I distilled it down to, let me find my pick, this.
Just born tonight, face down in a memory, but feeling all right. So who does your past belong to today? Baby, you don't say nothing when you're feeling this way. The girls in the bar saying, who is this guy? They don't think nothing when they're telling you lies. You look so careless when they're shooting that bull. You know heartaches are heroes when their pockets are full. Tell me you're trying to kill the 7-year ache. See what else your old heart can take. Boys say, when is he gonna give us some room? The girls say, God, I hope he comes back soon. she's talking, she don't hear a thing. You're still uptown on your downhill swing. The boulevard's empty, why don't you come around? Baby, what is so great about sleeping downtown? There's plenty of times to be someone you're not. You say you're looking for something you might have forgot. Don't bother calling to say you're leaving alone, 'cause there's a fool on every corner when you're trying to get home. Just tell her you're trying to kill the 7-year ache. See what else your old heart can take. Boy, say, when is he gonna give some room? The girl say, God, I hope he comes back soon. Tell her you're trying to kill the 7-year ache.
You're happy to sing classic songs of yours.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah. You don't mind going back to the mid-20s in your life and doing that?
You know, somewhere in my 30s, I got really tired of singing that song. Right. Thought, I am just so sick of singing my big hit record.
Right, right.
And I know, actually know young bands who say that. I'm not going to sing my hit anymore. It's selling out. It's
like, yeah, right.
Why
it's like 18
here?
Months after, though. That.
Right, exactly. You know those guys, too, right?
I do.
So I was kind of tired of singing it. Somewhere in my 40s, I started thinking, this girl who wrote this song was so young. How did she do that? You know, and I felt this just sense of tenderness about it. So now it's like singing a song my daughter wrote.
Right. Well, it's also nice to hear it just acoustic and the voice. I mean, I mean, as a guy that does a lot of radio and music, there is a certain 80s era of production that has sort of become a black hole to many people.
Sure.
And I like a lot of the production, but, you know, it's a time and place thing, whereas the 25-year-old could be yet another 25-year-old. Hopefully we'll never relive the 80s.
We already are, aren't we?
Or maybe, I don't know. Yeah, that's right.
I saw shoulder pads the other day.
Oh, that's right. The hairdos. Yeah, but it'll be a retro relive, and then we'll move on, and eventually retro will catch up with the current moment. I'm waiting for that to happen. I hope it's not a weird thing, but that way, then when retro gets in front of us, is when we really have to wonder.
That could be happening even as we speak, and we may not know it.
Yeah. It's equals mc² in culture is something like that. The speed of culture. But how do you feel when you listen to the records that are sort of finished products of another time? I mean, obviously you can update it like this, but how do you feel when you listen to the old records?
To my own
records?
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, that is an interesting question because I just had the opportunity and kind of the duty to do that because Sony just put out The Essential Roseanne Cash,
mm-hmm, right,
which is 32 years of songs.
Right.
36 songs over 32 years. So I was a little nervous about that because I don't sit around listening to my own records, you know, and was nervous about going back to those older ones, particularly the 80s. You were talking about big production, big snare sounds.
Another time in your life.
Another time in my life. Well, I started listening to it sequentially, you know, starting with this song I wrote that was on a German record I made that was never released in the United States. When I was 22 years old.
Did that get included?
Yes, it's on Essential.
Oh, okay.
So I was so young.
That's brave, you know, by the way.
I thought it was going to be braver than it actually was. When I heard it, I thought, well, that's sweet.
It
should,
you
know,
it. Yeah.
It has historical moment. But when I got to that stuff that you're talking about, I thought, well, this is really indicative of time and place, as you said. And so it deserves to be there for what it was and, you know, what it meant then.
Mm.
One of the great lines you had in your book, and I think you have it towards the end, but it's apparent, I think, it continually resurges. You say that you had an exhausting dance with his legacy, meaning your father, Johnny Cash's legacy. What can you say? I mean, it seems to me that on one hand you inherited something so beautiful and valuable, on the other hand you struggled, but the struggle for yourself is important too.
Sure.
We react to our parents.
At my age, the struggle is over. It's just the gift of what he left for me and for my daughter, who's the musician too.
Right.
So I find myself to be the middle of the story,
right,
rather than the end, which is the most wonderful feeling. But sure, I struggled with it. I wanted to be a songwriter and a performer, a musician, and I had this really great, probably one of the top five greatest artists of the 20th century in my very home. Why would I do anything to compare myself to that?
Sure. No, very difficult.
Very difficult, but would have been worse if I had been a boy. And
right,
I
was thinking
that.
Yeah, you had a gender advantage on that
I did have a gender advantage, and I was stubborn, and I was independent, and I...
Sounds like dad a little bit, though, too.
Yes.
Those are the deep-lying values
That's
underneath.
That's right, the deep-lying values. And I didn't ask for advice, and I pushed away. And I think even at some points, you know, he was a little hurt that I pushed away so much, but he knew I had to do it on my own.
Right.
And
seems like he was pretty big-hearted about that
stuff.
Oh,
my gosh, he was. The only thing he said to me, he says, "I'm so glad that you didn't change your name."
Did you ever consider it?
Sure.
Yeah? Did you have it? Can you tell us any names you were thinking
of? It was going to be my grandmother's maiden name, Rivers.
Well, of course, Johnny Rivers already had that.
Yes. But my dad, that would have hurt him.
Yeah.
So he was very happy I didn't do that. Yeah. I probably pushed away longer than necessary just because it became a reflex and I really wanted to do it on my own. At this point and in my 40s, I started embracing all of it.
Yeah.
It was his deepest self, this music, the music of Delta blues and Southern gospel and Appalachian and early country music, protest songs, folk songs. That was like the map of his soul. So for him to share it is he shared himself.
Did you ever have a moment where you said that you didn't think you loved him? I mean, every kid
loved
yells.
My dad?
Yeah.
No, I
didn't think so. In the book, it feels that way. But on the other side of it, sometimes a kid will just go into a fit for a day or two, and can't deal with it. And then all of a sudden goes, "Oh, wait a minute, there will be no other of this person."
No,
that's good.
I felt very connected to my dad. I've read things that said, we had. Or estranged and had hard time. We never did.
Yeah.
I mean, I was sure I was angry with him when he was a drug addict.
Right.
So when he was an active addict, that causes all kinds of problems.
Well, in the public arena, I mean, he's been a balladeer, a rockabilly, a bad boy. I guess that goes with drug addict, political activist, social advocate, humorist, man of peace, man of God, pop culture icon. But to you, in one moment, he just is daddy at the most primordial level. So balancing daddy versus all those personae that are out there, that's a juggling act, I would think, and hard to deal with.
Sure, and it was hard to be magnanimous about sharing him when I was younger. That's not hard, because I could sit here and talk to you about Johnny Cash and everything he means to the universe at large and the body of his work and the paradox of a man that he was. But when I go home, I still have dad.
Right.
You know, that's separate.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your mother for a minute. I mean, in life, you really have had two mothers, it seems to me, and you're a mother yourself. Say a little bit about your girlhood with your mother and your dad's first wife.
My mother, Vivian, was...
Vivian Liberto.
Liberto. She was very strict. She was Italian Catholic. And she was volatile, particularly around my dad's addiction, which she couldn't understand. And all of the things that came with the addiction, and his travel, his constant travel, and ultimately his fame. That was very hard for her. She did not grow up prepared for that.
Well, and she seems to have been a bright personality and bon vivant in her own right, but within the world she chose to be part of. So it's pretty tough to balance the gigantic with the local garden.
That's right. So when she and my dad split, which was the best thing that ever happened.
To both of them.
Right, because then they could both be happy. Right. Then she did bloom and blossom,
right.
You know?
Right, and you mentioned that beautifully in the book, coming back to her and seeing her in new ways. But still you seem to respect the strictness.
I do. And she taught me discipline.
You know, girl, you can do it that way.
That's right.
Go to your room,
Right. Well, and also to focus on things, to finish them, to, to have an inner structure. Mm.
But she's Catholic.
Yeah.
Your father, a classic Southern
Baptist.
Baptist, yeah. How did the worlds of religion mingle in your mind? Those are rather different legacies that you have to adjust to.
I tried them all on for size.
Yeah.
I left Catholicism at the age of 16. It nearly broke my mother's heart, but I knew I wasn't a Catholic. Mm. And then I tried on my dad's religion. I ultimately left that too. But he didn't really care about that kind of thing.
Right.
He cared about, he was a mystic.
Yeah, he seemed to live the goodness of Christianity rather than bring out the switch and the punitive side of it.
But it was even bigger than Christianity.
Yeah,
it was like his large feeling of what God was in his life, mm-hmm. The music for number one and the source of that music, that, in a way, he was, like I said, a mystic.
Well, if there's a conclusion you drew from it that's quotable from the book, art is a more trustworthy experience of God than religion.
For me.
But I think that's an amazing, succinct conclusion to be able to come to.
And it took my entire life to come to it.
And that's why it's such a great conclusion. I mean, it's very hard to get to that
and
focus.
I don't mean it as any offense for people who are religious, because my own daughter is now Catholic, one of my daughters. Can you imagine, full circle?
Yeah.
But for me, art is where I find God.
Right. Well, your dad didn't seem to be a proselytizer. And,
not at all.
That's what's so interesting about him, that larger mystical quality. The thing that I have to ask you about that's always intrigued me is, like many, I grew up as a huge fan. Obviously, you have your life. You've created all this work here. But there's something parallel about the worlds that I find interesting. Your dad grew up in the world of sharecropping and the Anglo and Afro South of the Mississippi Delta on the Arkansas side. He comes into the world of rockabilly, but he becomes so much more than that. I mean, in Get Rhythm, we were talking, he sings about the shoeshine boy, and almost like a documentarian, but then there's the hope of the boy will get rid of his blues by shining shoes. He received all this oral tradition, gospel, mm-hmm. and old-time country music, the ballad forms. He fused them in his way that was amazing fusion. But it seems to me that you've struggled in your own way with the question of the antiquity of what was around you and you cared about from him and in your own life, and then modernity. How do we live in a modern moment? And you've made so many songs that do address modern life very directly, written them. He had a lot from oral tradition, and I think you heard oral tradition too. But where do you carry that forward?
That is an endlessly fascinating subject to me, not only in my work, but in the body of American roots music.
Sure.
And what it means to us as Americans,
right.
And the traditions of that music going back to Celtic times, Elizabethan times, Appalachian songs that were filtered there, the banjo that really came from Africa, and before it became a bluegrass instrument. All of that interests me so, so much. And I feel almost a responsibility about this music that, like, I played a Sea of Heartbreak, the old Don Gibson tune once, and somebody said, did you write that? Not even close.
But you represented it in performance, and you made a choice to do it,
right.
And it sounded good to somebody.
Right.
And almost, in the old ballad tradition, it said, the song is bigger than you, almost.
Right. And do you know, when I was on the road with my dad when I was 18, the Carter family and Carl Perkins were also on that first summer tour I was on.
Wow.
And it was
that's a great
awesome.
Tour.
I sat in the dressing room every night, and all of them would teach me songs. It's when I learned to play guitar on that tour. And Helen and Anita and June and Maybelle Carter all taught me songs, but Helen Carter.
So you really got oral tradition directly that way.
That's right.
On the bus rather than in the log cabin.
Right. Well, in the dressing room. She taught me virtually the entire Carter family lexicon.
Wow.
And in a way is just to say, keep this alive.
Right.
It doesn't belong in a museum.
No,
keep
I love
it.
But of course, the Carters. I mean, AP himself was a collector of sorts and went out and wrote
yes.
them down. He wrote down blues. So we shouldn't think of it as all just somehow oral tradition over the centuries.
No.
There's contact. There's interest. People are native intelligence, whether they're urbane or not, is not the question. It's what do they listen for?
Right.
What do they care about?
Do you know? I lost my voice a couple times, but the first time I lost my voice, I had polyps. I had to go to this.
You mentioned that quite
right.
poignantly.
I went to a vocal therapist, and he started, when I went to see him, pulling out this book of American folk songs. And he would point to a song, and he'd say, how do you know that one? Because I always knew them slightly different than in the book, differently.
Right.
And the way I'd learned them through an oral tradition, you know, the way that my father sang a... you know,
old child ballad,
Wayfaring Stranger
right.
or something,
oh, yeah,
which has
right.
multiple
variations.
Interpretations.
Sure, sure, sure.
Or there was a Carter Family song called Merry Golden Tree
mm-hmm.
that I suddenly heard in an Aaron Copland piece.
Right.
Reinvented.
Right. Of course, Copland studied the vernacular,
of course
too,
he did,
in his
yeah.
highly, you know, modernist way and beautiful in many
but
cases.
But there's a song on the list that's like that, that's
yeah.
Bob Dylan's song. That
he
borrowed so heavily from Elizabethan music for this particular song.
Well, of course, Dylan was a great taker.
Absolutely. Still is.
And the album, well, the very name Love and Theft, you know, for a record, sort of says you love it, so you steal it. Or you know, you love it and you recreate.
You know that saying, mediocre artists borrow, great artists steal.
There you go. It was just refreshed in my mind. Thank you. So the list. I mean, that really speaks to your dad's almost collecting instinct, whether it's ORAL tradition from the ear, or I should say the tongue, or AURAL listening, which kind of always fuse. And you've got something from the list you'd like to bring us that your dad did.
Yes. The list, for those who don't know, was an actual list that my dad made me when I was 18 years old.
Is it handwritten?
Handwritten. There was no Google then, my friend.
No.
and of 100 essential songs.
Right.
This song was on the list. He recorded it with Bob Dylan in 1969.
Right.
I borrowed from Bob's original version from 1963. I will
okay. do it. Let's move down the list here. With Roseanne Cash and a song shared by her father and Bob Dylan.
If you're traveling in the North Country Fair, winds here. Times I've often prayed my night. In the brightness of my day. So if you're traveling in the North Country Fair, the winds hit heavy on the borderline. Remember me to one who lives there. She once was a true love of
mine. You, you deserve a drink. It's either vodka or water. I'm not sure
which. I
think
it's water.
Yeah, probably be better off that way. You kept the gender. You chose to, you know, go with the song.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that old folk tradition of women singing about other women, because it broadens the landscape. You don't know.
Right.
Is it a sister, your mother,
right,
your friend, your lover? I did it in Long Black Veil, too.
Mm.
And it's just, that's a very old folk tradition.
Right.
Celtic music, women sing about women all the time.
So antiquity and modernity can somehow live beautifully together if we're lucky. You spent time on the road with your dad. You mentioned a little later with the Carter family. But why, in the end, after you're beginning sort of inside the biz, the logistics, the finance, the road managing, why did you then have to go to England and do the work you were doing over there? What was it that kind of pushed you?
I was so young when I went to England. I was 20. Mm. And I was just floundering. I knew I wanted to be a songwriter. I wasn't any good at it yet. I was in love with someone, and he broke my heart. I'd always wanted to be in London, so I said, this is the time to go.
And those were high times there.
Yeah. Well, it was a great era for music, you know. I went to see the Small Faces, and I saw the Rolling Stones. I mean, it was great.
And you didn't not like the Beatles.
I didn't not like the Beatles, true. I loved them. But it was a coming-of-age experience. I wrote a lot about it in my book.
No, it's a beautiful narrative. Was that a source of conflict at some point, being away? I mean, what gets you back?
Well, I had this very glamorous notion of myself as an expatriate and that I would stay. And my dad was financing this. He was paying my rent. You know, I was working at Columbia, but they gave me £40 a week, which didn't pay for anything. So I came home for a visit after 6 months, and he said, that's it. You have to stay home now.
That was his one sort of editorial restriction, huh?
That was the strictest he ever was with me. And I was so upset with him and depressed after he made me do it. But he was afraid that I would not come back.
Right. So when you get back to America at that point, what year would that have been?
76.
Okay, so we're into the mid-70s, and there's still a certain amount of upheaval and turmoil and questions. God, it sounds like today, except it seems a little bleaker today. Then everything was kind of like possible, it seemed to me.
Yeah.
What did you find, I mean, in music and family life? How did you adjust on the return?
Well, I went back to college. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, you know, what am I going to do with myself? I need some more education. So I got a second year of college. I went to Vanderbilt for my second year.
In Nashville.
And I studied drama and English. And then I thought, I went to acting school. I left and went to Los Angeles and went to the Lee Strasberg Institute. I actually audited classes of Lee Strasberg.
That's amazing.
I know. It was pretty amazing. He was terrifying, absolutely terrifying.
Right.
But, you know, after 6 months there, I thought, I don't want to be an actor. What am I doing? It was just, you know, one of those kind of year-long dark moments of the soul. And then I really started working at my songwriting.
What is it that tipped you over to feel you could write songs and then sing your own songs and not be covering other people? Though you do some beautiful covers, obviously the list is filled with them now. But what does it kind of get you over the edge there?
I wanted it so bad.
Yeah.
And I thought, I have to do it whether I'm any good at it or not. I want it so bad. I want to be a great songwriter. Mm. So I just kept showing up for work. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just kept showing up for it, kept working. And eventually I wrote a good song.
Mm. What do you think was the real good one?
Well, it wasn't that great. It was a song called This Has Happened Before. I recorded it on my first album. Mm-hmm. But it was the first time I knew I could do it.
Yeah.
And
did you feel measured against the Nashville world? I mean, that's a town of professional songwriters that secret themselves somewhere and crank them out.
Yeah, not really. I mean, I wrote that song in Germany. I was living in Germany at that
point. Okay, so you were already there with that.
Yeah. And I never kind of saw myself as part of that system. A couple times I tried to co-write, you know how you go in a room and co-write in Nashville?
Right.
It's very famous for that. All we did was order lunch. I never wrote anything.
Well, you need to eat.
Yeah. But being a performer, that took a lot longer for me to grow into. I was doing it before I wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I, if you don't mind, I wanted to read something back that you wrote. Because I think of the writing in this book as somewhat like songs and a long elegiac statement of your life. And this will put you in the world of, I guess... by the time your father's now living in Nashville in the house at the lake, and mm-hmm. you recount your early teens here. Those summers of my early teens were glorious. Dad taught all of us to water ski. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on, that's awesome. Johnny Cash water skiing, we love it. And we swam in his giant rock pool that fed into the lake, and we went on long Jeep rides at his farm in Bon Aqua. It'd be beautiful water, I think, mm-hmm. 70 miles from the lake house. We picked wild blackberries, and he played guitar, and we sang in the evenings. Out on the lawn after the sun went down, he made homemade peach ice cream with peaches from his orchard, setting off firecrackers while he cranked the ice cream maker. And he never seemed to tire of that. And then you jump ahead, and you note something that's about public and private life. I love this. He rented the roller skating rink so we could skate together undisturbed by fans. I mean, that's a rarefied life, but you've put it so beautifully. When it was happening, did you see it as significant? Like, I mean, reading that is just phenomenal.
Well, that was the era my dad had his television show.
Right.
And he won, you know, one year he won like 4 Grammys or something in a year. And he was so famous at that time that he really couldn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
And he wanted to spend some time with his kids. So what do? You rent the movie theater, you rent the school, roller skating rink.
You recreate intimacy by putting up the barriers that the wealth and the fame affords.
Yeah. And he wasn't, you know, there was nothing pretentious about it at all.
He's just being a family man
That's
at that
right.
point.
Yeah.
No, it's a beautiful thing. But as you wrote these songs, I mean, here's Nashville. I mean, the words music and industry kind of have always freaked me out side by side.
Me too.
So here you are in Nashville.
Yeah.
Who were you writing the songs and performing for? Did you feel like you wanted to be a Nashville star, or were you just trying to be Roseanne writes her favorite songs and keeps moving?
No, you know, Nick, in my first record, I was still living in California.
Okay.
And the second record, I was still in California.
So you were still in that, you know,
I was
identity.
Outside the system.
Right.
And then,
that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, and Nashville signed me. Columbia Nashville signed me. So I thought, well, you know, there might be an earthquake. I have a little baby. Let's move to Nashville.
Yeah.
So we did. Really, that figured hugely in my thoughts because I had been through a bunch of earthquakes. And,
right.
And I had a baby, and suddenly earthquakes mattered.
Right.
So we moved to Nashville, and I still felt somewhat outside the system.
Right.
When I moved to Nashville, I had purple hair.
Yeah, yeah.
Not red,
yeah,
purple.
That didn't pass the color test in Nashville, does it?
It was shocking. I couldn't get a bagel. You know, I was a little bit stuck up.
You now can get bagels in Nashville.
Yes, you could. You can, so, but you could not then.
Then no. It's Nashville's come a long way. You're in Nashville. I guess you can go out to the lake house and hang out.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing.
Yeah.
As that reconnects you, you know, with your dad. But what about your, you know, did your, how fast did you rub up against it? I mean, you're having hits. I mean, you know, you're, Nashville loves people that have hits, I've noticed. So they must have loved you, some of people there. We loved you, we the public.
No, I felt included in some things and excluded in some things, yeah. To be perfectly honest. Right. I didn't see the country music industry as a religion. Like, I didn't feel like I had to toe a party line. And some people thought that I should. Right. And I didn't understand that. And I didn't understand the iconography either.
Right.
Like, well, my hair can't be purple? Why? The record's still good.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So that kind of thing, you know, butted right. heads a few times. But it turned out okay.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
I grew into it there. I lived there 9 years. I had great friends. The songwriting community in Nashville is unbelievably
and I think it still is pretty strong, actually.
So
there's
inspiring.
An alternative world there now that's grown and been
absolutely.
Great.
My daughter's yeah. there.
Right.
She's in that alternative world. But even then, in the late 70s, when I moved there, early 80s, the songwriters, Guy Clark was there, Mickey Newberry, Towns Van Zandt.
Arguably,
you know,
you helped open things up for Nashville by your presence and their presence. And
I don't like to see it that way.
No.
And you
were married to Rodney Crowell in that period, and you made a lot of great records,
yeah.
And it was a time and a place. And, you know, you move on to New York, but as you look back at Nashville today, it seems like you don't have any big edge about it. I mean, Nashville
is
Nashville.
No, I have a great fondness for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And my daughter is there, you know.
Right.
Two daughters are there, actually. My stepdaughter, who's married and has children, lives there, too. So I love going there, love the music scene. Mm. It's great.
Let's talk
I
about...
I love the South in general.
Right. But you kind of had to, like, leave the family, well, go to
true.
Europe, go to the West Coast,
yeah.
be in Nashville. Then. But, I mean, you're kind of really all American, and yet you love the South.
I love the South, but I'm a New Yorker.
Yeah.
You know,
Here you go.
You know that saying, we always thought she was kind of weird, turns out she's just a New Yorker.
Well, there's a lot of New Yorkers that don't love the South, which is unfortunate. I mean, I think they're missing something, but... Provincialism rears its head wherever you go.
Oh, no. I get Garden and Gun magazine.
Oh, right.
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the Carter family, and you mentioned the music. Suddenly you've got a new mother, and she insisted on not calling you stepchildren.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of like your dad's the lowlands person and the old... blues, gospel, roots, rockabilly guy, and then suddenly here's the mountains. This is
right.
like the perfect unity in country music to take the uplands and the lowlands. But it's more complicated than that for you,
yeah.
of course.
Well, they thought it was the perfect union too.
Oh, good.
Not only
that
personally,
helps.
But musically, yeah. June was great because I feel I had these two very strong maternal figures in my life who gave me very different things. June was such a natural performer. You know, she'd been on the road her whole life. She was exactly the same off stage as she was on. She could be having a conversation with you, walk on stage, do her show, come back out and come off and, you know, continue the conversation.
That's big time.
And it was so natural to her that I started to feel it could be natural to me. It was a great, great gift to give me. And another gift she gave me is she was widely traveled, you know, because she'd been everywhere. And I remember once we were going to Europe, we were sitting in first class, and the cart, back then they served caviar on planes, if you can imagine. So the cat.
Little foil packets.
Yeah. The cart comes down, and the flight attendant asks if we would like caviar. She says yes. And I turn up my nose, a 19-year-old girl. I say, ew, no, thank you. And she just started eating, and she turns to me, and she says, you are the type of woman who would love caviar. And I thought...
She's acknowledging your urbanity at that point, huh?
I am.
Kind of guilt-tripping you into the urbanity, maybe, but...
No, she was telling...
she was
sincere.
She
did that often. She told me who I was when I couldn't see it myself.
That's so sweet.
You are the type of woman who would love antiques,
right,
you know?
Right.
Who would feel natural on stage.
Your own motherhood really comes through in the book, too, and the lessons you learned from your two mothers and everything else in life. And it's really a great thing to hear you hear. I'm saying this. I feel like the voices in my own head, you speaking, talking about your kids, your, mm-hmm. Four daughters, and then later one son.
Yeah.
So, where? How have you done it differently? I mean, I know you give a lot of very conscious images of birthing and leading up to it, and what the child means at the time, and how they've changed. Mm-hmm. But you have done it differently, it seems to me, than your two mothers.
Yes. But doesn't every woman want to improve on what her mother did, you know? And do we, actually? I'm not sure. But
well, we adapt to the times.
We adapt to the times. And I think I actually, my mother was very strict, so I thought, I am not going to be strict. And I had one rule their entire childhood, which is that they couldn't drink juice after 5 p.m.
Yeah.
It was pathetic.
Oh, that's rough.
It's rough.
Rough
it's
stuff.
Pathetic. Well, you know, I came to realize that maybe parenting wasn't a democracy and maybe I should set a few more limits. So, you know, I went too far and came back. But yeah. I had my last child, my son, at the age of 43, which in some ways is the perfect age to have a baby.
Because your identity is more squared out and you have a sense of why and how and what.
It's all gratitude.
Yeah.
Every moment is precious to me with this kid.
I relate. I have a 6 and an 8-year-old. And, you know, it's like,
so sweet.
Yeah, well, sometimes I think maybe sooner, but you're a more experienced parent than I. And the book is good for parents.
Well,
you know, it really is. You get a lot of advice in there. You don't preach. You just lay out the examples.
I hope I don't give advice.
Let's put it this way. You can take it as advice, but the examples are beautifully written.
Right. I never wanted to do that, you know. I never wanted to write a kind of lofty, you know, it my way kind of book.
Right.
And I never wanted to write a, you know, a scandalous kind of trashy, hurt people book. I hate those kind of books.
No, you tell the truth, but you do it through the beauty of your prose. And I think that's what makes it a remarkable work. And your husband, John
Leventhal.
And who your dad made a little bit about how he was Jewish. Your dad had him being more Jewish than John probably thought he was, it sounds like.
My dad.
Dad took him more seriously than John
did. When I told my dad I was marrying John, he sighed, he said, thank God, I've been waiting 40 years for one of my daughters to marry a Jew.
That sounds like the Old Testament amount of time wandering meets the chance to kind of reconnect the spheres. That's beautiful that he put it in such cosmic terms. So. I love it. And you guys make music together. And how is it going on the road playing with your husband?
It's
very different than the old days.
It is. It's good. We've already worked out all of our crap. You know, if he says that's a G chord, not a D, I don't take it personally.
Right, there you go.
Whereas early on, I would have. Something romantic, very romantic, capital R romantic, mystically romantic about creating music together.
Yeah.
I love it. And through our hardest times, and marriage is not easy, as everyone knows, through our hardest times, that has kept us together.
Yeah.
And even if we've gotten in a terrible fight and we go on stage, I hear him play a solo, how can I be mad at him?
Right, right.
I see why I love him.
You know, that takes me to one of their thing that you wrote here. Let's see if I can find it. And this speaks, I think, to the power of performance and the public and the private. And this is a time when there was some anger between you and your dad. And you say, one of the sweetest moments in my life occurred the last time my dad played Carnegie Hall. I'd been a little angry with him the day before the show. And he brought up some old grievances, which he listened to. I brought up some old grievances, which he listened to with patient grace. After hearing me out, he invited me to sing I Still Miss Someone. I love that. To sing it with him the next night, I demurred. The day of the performance, he asked me if I'd change my mind and would join him on stage. And there's a three-time asking. That sounds biblical, too, like the Jesus in the garden or something. and you keep declining, and then you say, I declined once more, but as I watched him walk out of the room, there was something about, I love this, the look of his back and the look of him walking away and the memory of the thousands of times I'd seen his strong back from the wings as he faced an audience that made me suddenly realize what it meant to him. I called after him, Dad, I'll do it. And you sang together, the pain dissolves. Mm-hmm. So you're having that intimate experience through your family and yet you're in public, but this is a public like you folks and everyone watching out there who love you and love what you do. So it gave you, you were in the crowd but also intimate in that same moment. Beautiful writing and great moment.
It was a great moment, and I realized fully for the first time that my dad worked out all of his problems under the spotlight.
Interesting.
His best self was there, and his relationship with an audience was deeply healing.
Whether it's the prisoners or whomever.
Yeah, it was alchemy for him.
Yeah, yeah.
And so taking me out there, it actually healed something for us too. It was.
But haven't you done that too by writing all these songs from the heart and the brain?
Absolutely.
And your book. I mean, you are on one level laying bare some things about your life, and on the other level, you are. You know, the things that are truly personal, it seems to me, remain respectfully personal.
Yeah. Yes. But I don't feel that it's just, oh, I'm going to express myself, you know? I mean, toddlers do that,
right?
It's more, it's the crafting and the work and making something artful of it.
Right.
That's what's meaningful to me.
Well, yeah, and your reflections on the time when you maybe were more thinking like that in your 20s, you're a little sheepish about that.
Sure.
And saying how it bothered you. When do you think you began to feel that you really liked your voice? I mean, I think you found your voice singing fairly early, but when did you actually say to yourself, hey, I sound good? Do you still say, or you?
Well, it comes and goes, you know. I did something last week, I thought, I sound good, and then I listened to something else, I said, I sound terrible. It took a long time to grow into my voice. I was around Emmylou Harris a lot in my early career, and she was a friend and so kind to me and always encouraging, but I started to make her voice as the standard in my mind, and my voice is completely different from hers,
right?
And so I thought, well, I'm never going to be like Emmylou, so that means I'm not a good singer. Well, it took me a while to grow up and go, well,
right.
I have to be authentically myself. What is my voice like,
right,
you
right.
know? It took a while, and now I'm comfortable with it. Ray Charles he said something so great. He said, you're a better singer at 50 than you were at 20.
Right.
You know, because you have a life in back of your
you
voice.
You understand
now.
What your voice means when you that, sing. Well, you mentioned, actually, I love your Patsy Cline comes to dinner stories where,
yeah.
you know, you love her, her elegance, her beauty, her voice, and then she's like pretty rough.
She cursed like a sailor.
You just wouldn't think that of Patsy Cline, you know. But I mean, you have these role models around, and later Linda Ronstadt, and then you mentioned Emmylou, and
Linda said something that kind of became my mantra, it was the sentence that opened the path before me. She said, "To refine your skills so you can support your instincts," because I did have huge instincts as an artist. I wanted so much. I had such feeling and passion for it, but I couldn't do it yet.
Sure.
And I had to keep showing up for work. Just keep showing up, just refining. You know, Guy Clark, I studied at the knee of Guy Clark in songwriting in some ways, and he would say, you have to throw out the best line of your song if it doesn't serve the rest of the song. And he
That's
was
a tough
ruthless.
One to learn.
Ruthless.
Yeah.
It is tough.
Yeah.
So I kept showing up, and eventually, my skills were more refined.
You know, the one song of your dad's that you did, and it was his hit and your hit too, and I guess is it Gary Scruggs plays on Tennessee Flat Top Box?
Randy
Scruggs, his brother.
That's who broke my heart when I moved to England.
Oh, well. You heard it here on Kentucky Authors Forum. Or was it conversation? Well, anyway.
I say so in the book. It's not
yeah,
a huge
right.
surprise
it's no
to
big,
Randy.
No big secret. Yeah, yeah. No, it's flattering, I'm sure, for him, too. But the music is so beautiful there. But what I loved was that you know, ultimately you took one of those songs and you were able to make it yours and your hit and a great song down the middle like that. And I would assume you were pretty happy with that one.
With Tennessee Flat Top
yeah.
Box? Yeah, you know, Rodney produced that record. It was on King's Record Shop.
Right.
Which cover was
right
here.
Right here, Mobile.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, the home team.
Right. And he said, why don't you do this song of your dad's Tennessee Flat Top Box? You know, it's a great story song. You can be like a narrator in it. It's kind of cinematic. And I said, all right, well, that seems like a good song for me to do. And I said, but I don't think my dad wrote this song. And Rodney said, I think he did. I said, no, I think it's public domain because it's, you know, I've known it my whole life, so it's really old. So we recorded it, and then, of course, you know, there wasn't Google then. We couldn't have found out that. So then found out that, in fact, he did write it.
That's right.
So I told
He is public domain.
He is public domain. Indeed, he is. So I told my dad the story. Well, the record became a number one record, and my dad took out a full-page ad in Billboard saying, I'm so proud you didn't know I wrote it when you recorded it.
Yeah, that's beautiful. You know, you've mentioned that, you know, the loss of your parents and the period of mourning, but at the same time, and in the book you've got your orations from the funerals, which are really pretty amazing. You wrote them down, and they read beautifully. But just tell us about, you know, your own sense of reconciliation with your parents' legacy, and what that does for you personally, musically, as you move past that.
Well, and much like the book, I felt as if that if I didn't embrace the legacy that had been left for me musically, that someone else would co-opt it, who it didn't belong to.
Right.
And I started seeing that on the horizon in some ways. People speaking for my father, or, you know, acting as if they were the rightful heir to that musical legacy. So my hackles came up a bit, to tell you the truth, and I thought, but this is something he left me. And then I thought, why haven't you stepped into it? Why haven't you accepted it? What a tremendous gift, and why are you not doing this? And also, I had brain surgery.
Right.
And I got a good, hard look at my own mortality.
Right.
And I thought of two things when I was recovering. I want to write this book, and I want to make the list. And both of them were about accepting legacy and telling my own story. Because I also knew if I didn't tell my own story, it also would be co-opted, because it has many, many times. I've read so many false things about myself. I thought, why are you not telling it yourself? Mm-hmm. You know. So both of those things I did. That was my bucket list after the brain surgery, and I did both of them.
Congratulations on getting it done. I think she deserves a round of applause for getting it done. That's another model for us all, really, I think. You did the Black Cadillac CD, and I love the fact that, you know, you could take that as funereal, or you could take it as rockabilly. The man in black has a black Cadillac, too.
Yeah.
And there's something beautiful about that. But there is a song from that CD, and as we kind of wrap our thinking about your work and your family and where you're headed, would you mind giving us a tune from Black Cadillac?
I will.
Yeah. Roseanne Cash, one more time.
I should say a little something about this song. I wrote it shortly after my dad died, and in the last year of his life, he liked me to read to him. So, and he liked to hear the Psalms, so I read Psalms, and for the first time realized how poetic the Psalms are. I know it seems obvious, but it's like, wow, some great artist wrote these. But there is a line in one of the Psalms about being a sparrow on the roof. And that's how I open it. I'm the sparrow. Westward leading, still proceeding.
I'm the mirror in the hall. From your empty room, I can hear it fall. Now that westward leading, still proceeding to the world unseen.
Roseanne Cash. The book is called Composed.